Please do be seated. Well, eagle watchers of the term card will know that we're beginning a new summer evening series tonight, looking at the stories of Jesus that are only told us by Matthew, the parables exclusive to Matthew's gospel. And we begin tonight with the one that Helen read for us from Matthew chapter 13. It's on page 13 of the Bibles in the seats, and it would be a great help to me if you would turn to it. Matthew 13 on page 13 at the back part of the Bibles. And as you do turn to it, let me ask you a question. I wonder whether you've ever had the experience of looking at something only to discover that the thing you've been looking at isn't the whole picture. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, I remember going out into my back garden and seeing a cat right at the back of the garden. And so I moved towards it and went, psst, psst. And as I got closer to it, the cat remained absolutely still. Psst. I went. And as I got close to this static can, I discovered that it wasn't a cat at all, but was in fact my watering can. At which point I immediately looked all around me to see whether anyone else had seen what an absolute burk I'd made of myself. And it is possible for us to look at things and then later discover that they're not quite what they seem. Well, Matthew chapter 13 is a chapter of parables that Jesus tells that are something like that. They're parables that teach us that the way we see the kingdom of heaven now isn't in fact the full picture, isn't in fact the whole story. That it's possible to look at things now, or it was possible for the disciples to look at things in their time and miss the whole picture. That it's possible to look at things now and be misled by just appearances. Now, Matthew 13 is the third of five teaching blocks in Matthew's Gospel. Matthew brings all of Jesus' teaching together in his Gospel into five chunks, and he intersperses those chunks with all the action parts of the Gospel, and he weaves them together very cleverly. Well, this third block, Matthew 13, is made up of eight parables, the first three of which are all parables of the kind, "It's different to how it really is," or "different to how it seems." So you'll look at something and it's in fact different to it. So Jesus explains in these three parables that the kingdom of heaven may be explained by the parable of the sower or the soils, our parable tonight of wheat and weeds, and then the third one, the parable of the mustard seed. Right from the beginning of the gospel, Jesus has come preaching that the kingdom of heaven is at hand, or that the kingdom of heaven is near. That's the gospel message that he is preaching as he goes from village to village in the early chapters of Matthew's gospel. But later, in chapters 8, 9 and 10, particularly of Matthew's gospel, this kingdom is explained to us in terms of a king. The kingdom that is near has a king, and that king is Jesus himself. Matthew shows us that by all various miracles that Jesus performs. But what's the kingdom like? If a kingdom is at hand, if Jesus is the king of that kingdom, what's the kingdom like? What can it be compared? Well, it can be compared by a parable of soils, or the parable of the sower, and that's verses 1 to 9 of chapter 13. The point of it being, well, that the disciples will look at things now and see them not as they really are in broad, total picture. So the disciples would look at the situation, Jesus preaching the kingdom of heaven, and the response is very weak. It's very poor. In fact, you might even think that the gospel preaching was a failure in the first century as Jesus wandered from village to village. You know, for three quarters of the seed that's sown is completely wasted. Some of it falls on pathways and birds come and gobble. Some of it falls on rocks and the sun scorches and burns them up. Some fall among thorns and they choke it. But some falls on good soil. And the response to Jesus' preaching? Well, it looks a failure. It looks a failure now to the disciples, but that good seed in good soil, in fact, produces a terrific harvest, a massive crop, better than technological insecticiding 20th century mankind can produce today. Oh, the kingdom of heaven. It may look like a failure in terms of its results, but it'll produce a great harvest. Or the third parable, the parable of the mustard seed in verses 31 to 32. The mustard seed, the smallest of seeds. Perhaps Jesus held one in his hand as he told the parable. The smallest of seeds. But in fact, it'll become the largest of bushes, almost like a tree, where various birds will be able to make their nesting place. The kingdom of heaven, well, it'll start very small. It'll look very small to begin with, but in fact, the reality is that it'll become huge. It'll become vast. The kingdom of heaven, you may be deceived by the way it looks from the reality. Well, to verses 24 to 30, the parable of the weeds and the wheat, the third of the how it looks now is not all there is to it parable. Verses 24 to 30 provide us with the content of the parable. And as with most of Jesus' stories, his parables, it's full of imagery familiar to Jesus' hearers and to Matthew's readers, and perhaps slightly less familiar to us 20th century people, people many of us rarely see fields if we live in the city. Well, a man goes and sows seeds in his field. He sows wheat seeds. But an enemy comes at night and sows seeds among this wheat field, seeds that are weed seeds. So when the plants grow, the field is this mixed up land of both wheat and weeds. And it's a familiar thing in the first century. Often a farmer would sow his field full of wheat. But an enemy of his would come along, often at night, and amongst his field of wheat, sow weeds. Usually a weed called darnel. And he would sow it in the field, and Roman law prescribed against it and gave punishment for it. The weed darnel was very similar to wheat. It grew alongside the wheat. It entangled with the wheat. So that it was almost impossible in the early stages to tell them apart. And you often waited till harvest to do it. And if you tried to pull up the weeds before harvest, you would often pull up the wheat at the same time because their roots became entangled. It was a mean and vindictive act by an enemy to do in the first century. It'd be rather like a man growing prize roses for the Chelsea Flower Festival, only to find that a rival had managed to sow suckers in all the man's rose bushes. A familiar story in the first century. But what does it mean? Well, if you read some of the commentators, they'll tell you that it's impossible to interpret and understand parables. They're very hard to be dogmatic, what the imagery is all about. It's very hard to discern their meanings. Well, with the first of the six we're looking at on these summer Sunday evenings, there's no debate for the serious Bible student about what this one means. Turn over the page, if you will, and you will discover the greatest of commentators giving his exposition and explanation of its meaning. Jesus himself, in verses 36 to 43, explains privately to the disciples the meaning of the parable of the wheat and the weeds. A parable as explained by Jesus that's in three movements that we're going to notice briefly together. The present situation, then the future separation, and then the final judgment or final state. And let's look at each one in turn. The first is the longest, by the way, so if you think we're going to go on till tomorrow morning, we're not. The first, the present situation. Jesus here in parable form is giving us a picture or a description of the situation between his coming, he's the one who comes and sows the seeds, between his coming and then verse 40 we're told, between the close of the age. That is, his coming again. What will the situation be like between Jesus coming into the world and Jesus coming into the world for the second time? Well, the situation is that the world, because that's what the field is, according to Jesus' explanation, verse 38, the world will have this coexistence, this living alongside each other, of two types of seed. That the world will have this coexistence, this mixture of good and evil. Two types of seed, weeds and wheats, evil and good, sown by two different sowers, the devil and the Son of Man. In the parable, the servants come to the owner and they ask whether they should dig the weeds out. But the owner is insistent. That situation will have to remain. It'll have to remain good and evil, weeds and wheat, until harvest time, until the close of the age. until history is wrapped up. And so the present situation? The world will be a mixture of good and of evil. It's important for us to realise that this is a parable about the kingdom of heaven. Jesus is the king. Jesus is the king. He's come into the world, described at his birth as the king, preaching that the kingdom is near or is at hand. He's demonstrated that he's the king with impressive miracles. In chapter 8, the sick have been healed, the evil spirits have been cast out, the storm has been stilled. The kingdom is at hand, but what will it appear in the world now? How will it appear in the world now? How will it be until the end of time? It'll be this coexistence of good and evil. A coexistence of good and evil alongside each other. And this present situation has implications for the disciples of the first century and therefore has implications for us. Because why did Jesus tell these, it's not how it seems, sorts of parables to the disciples? Why tell those it's not as it seems parables? Well, because presumably they were tempted to think that it was as it seems. And the reality was what they saw. And therefore they must have been tempted to think that the message of the gospel was a failure, because that's how it seemed. Or that it was just very small, because that's how it seemed. You see, as the disciples, as we discover that Jesus is the King, as we discover that he's the Lord of heaven and earth, as we discover that everything is in his control, as Matthew has shown us so far in his gospel, that everything is under Jesus' power, as the disciples see the miracles, there must surely have been a pressure or temptation on them to think that Jesus' rule should be more clearly or visibly or demonstrably seen in the now. And we often think that too, that it ought to be more impressive visibly than it is. You see, if Jesus is the king, if Jesus has such power, surely the kingdom should be more impressive. Surely it should be demonstrably more powerful. That there shouldn't be such evil around in the world. If the king's come, if the king's broken into the world, the disciples, we mustn't be fooled. We mustn't be fooled by how we see things. By the fact that Jesus' rule perhaps doesn't appear to us as impressive as we think it ought to or we'd like to. This extraordinary mix-up in our world of good and evil is how it's going to be and is how it's going to be until the end. And grasping that will save us from many of the perils that Christians in other generations have traditionally fallen into. It'll save us from falling into a false expectation of now. And it'll rather give us a clear and proper realism. Now, Christians right through the ages, and many today, want perfection now. They want perfection this side of the close of time. Say, many liberation theologians dream of eradicating the world of all injustices, to have a social structure that's fully founded on Christian principles. Or perhaps at the other extreme, the extreme charismatic who will claim cities and areas for Jesus the King, banishing evil from those areas by their prayers, marching round them. Now, I'm all for justice in social structures, and I'm all for cities and colleges and areas being one for Jesus Christ. But we mustn't have a wrong expectation that all evil's going to go. That we're going to get the perfect structure in our society. That we'll ever get a perfect city or situation. That your college will become perfectly Christian. And that you can banish evil from it, even if you thought you could. No, it's going to be a coexistence of good and evil alongside each other. You can march around the city of London as much as you like, but you won't stop fraud in the banks. You can work for a Christian society, but it'll never be fully just. Our colleges, our companies, our countries are going to reflect the world where good and evil seeds are sown together. Some of you may have heard the Today programme a week last Friday, interviewing an American TV evangelist whose cable TV programme is going to be withdrawn because of broadcasting laws in this country. And so they interviewed this American TV evangelist at one of his rallies. And the background chorus that was being sung was one that I don't know, and I don't think that we sing it here. The lyrics went, "Victory, victory, total victory can be ours now." Now, we must beware of having an improper expectation of the now. Because the situation is going to be nothing other than this mixture of good or evil. We may be good seeds, but the field we're sown in is now no longer exclusively good. Indeed, it's far from it. And therefore we need to have a right expectation of the now, and we don't need to cook up or pretend or exaggerate how the gospel is now. We don't need to make claims for it that the gospels don't make for the gospel itself. We don't need to make it any more impressive. We don't need to super-duper it up. No, we need this right expectation of the now. And I think we need this right expectation of the now for another reason as well, so that we won't have our faith wobbled or be tempted to give up or be caused to seriously doubt that Jesus is in control, doubt that Jesus is properly the king. Because it's very easy for us to wonder from time to time, you know, if Jesus is in control, if Jesus really is the king, why is there so much evil? The disciples in Matthew's gospel may well have wondered that. Jesus heals the demoniac back in chapter 8, and what did the crowd do? They tell Jesus to push off. In chapter 12, Jesus heals a man whose hand has been withered. And what do the Pharisees do? They plot to kill him. After the resurrection, these disciples would see and they would experience evil thrown at them. Is he still the king? Is he still in control? You just think of the news this last week. Donald Leroy Evans confesses to murdering 60 people. Brain-blowing, isn't it? I just couldn't get my mind round that. Or three children have been brutally murdered in this last 8 days. 13 die in a boat that sinks outside Hong Kong Harbour. Hostages still captive in the Middle East. This man who goes shooting in a shopping precinct in Sydney on Friday. Is Jesus the king? The kingdom of heaven is at hand, is it? Well, good and evil will coexist till the close of the age. Jesus teaches the disciples so that they have this right perspective now, and you and I need that right perspective. So that we won't be fooled, so that we won't wander away from it. But I think there's another danger that is countered here that Jesus hints at, and that's the danger of early separation. If there's a danger of false expectation, there's a danger of early separation. Turn back to the parable itself, if you will, in verses 24 to 30, and cast your eye over it, and you'll notice that in the parable, the workers want to separate the wheat from the weeds before the harvest, and the owner won't allow it. The seed is to remain good, but it's to be amongst the evil. And it may be here that Jesus is showing the disciples that separation from the world isn't to be their way. Either to separate mentally by judging or through doing it physically. It's very easy to separate from the world by judging the world early, by thinking we can do it somehow. But already on the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has told us not to judge one another. And the reason is because with wheat and weeds here, if we judge, we'll get it wrong. It's very easy to pull up the wrong thing. And we're not therefore qualified for it. We must wait till the harvest when the angels can do it. I wonder whether you've ever played that April Fool joke. Before your people in your house come down to breakfast, you mix some salt in the sugar bowl. And they come down, they sprinkle what they think is sugar over their wheat flakes. They take their first mouthful. And you're lucky if you can get it off the floor, because it sticks. But try and separate the sugar and the salt afterwards. It's impossible. If you try and put a few grains out on the sideboard and pick out what the ones you think are the salt grains, and then taste them, I guarantee you'll have got some sugar ones too. It's impossible to do. And therefore Christians mustn't judge, because we'll do it wrong. We'll get it wrong. The servants here weren't to do it. They'd get it wrong. We mustn't think that some people are beyond, so we don't need to bother. But more especially, we mustn't separate from the world physically. That wasn't allowed here either. But it's been part of our temptation as Christians right from the beginning, right from the earliest days of the gospel, to separate from the world. Though here, evil and good are to rub shoulders together. So we will rub shoulders with evil at work, we'll do it in our homes, we'll do it in the clubs we belong to, we'll do it with our friends, and we'll do it with our relations. Oh yes, we're meant to be distinctively Christian. We ourselves aren't to be contaminated by the world, but we're not to separate from it. We're still to be part of it. And it's so easy for us to begin this slow, almost insidious separation from the world that we're part of. It was very easy for us to start no longer having Christian friends. You don't have to join a nunnery or a monastery or become a hermit as they did in the second century to do this separation. It's very easy for us just to do it, even though we're still going to work, we're still going to college with people who aren't Christians. No, early separation is not what we're allowed. That will happen later. So already you can see how relevant this parable was to the disciples, how relevant it is to us. The present situation, well, it's a coexistence of good and of evil. So don't expect Jesus' kingship to seem now more than it here is described. Don't pretend it's better, more impressive than it is. It is impressive, but may not seem it. Neither should we doubt that Jesus is still the king, just because we see evil in the world. And neither should we separate from the world, even though it's going to be hard for us at times to stay part of it. The present situation, but the parable moves on to a second movement. From the present situation to future separation. From now, it moves to harvest time. And every farmer understood the scenario. Whether it was just because there'd be a few weeds that naturally somehow just popped into his field, or whether it was because there would be many weeds because they had been sown by an enemy, at harvest time every farmer knew that wheat and weeds had to be separated. Up until then, with this particular weed, such separation would be difficult, as we've already said. But it was much easier, in fact it was a doddle at harvest time, because the wheat and the weeds may grow up alongside each other, but at harvest time you could easily distinguish them. The wheat, it had its grains at the top, a little bundle of them. The weeds, they had nothing. It was clearly evident which was which. Look back at the parable again, if you will, and see what happens. Verse 30, what happens? The weeds, they're gathered first, they're bound into bundles, and then they're sent to be burnt. And after that, the wheat is also gathered and then can be placed into barns. Over the page, let's see the explanation of it. What happens? What happens? There's going to be a closing of time. There's going to be a closing of time, and then the good will be separated from evil. Good and evil will then cease to coexist. Verse 40 and onwards. The kingdom of heaven then will have fully come. No longer will it be near, it'll be completely here. There'll be no evil notice. There'll be no evildoers notice. And notice, there'll be nothing that causes evil. There's coming a great divide. And at that divide, there's just going to be two groups. Only two groups? Well, only two groups, because there have only been two seeds, two types of seeds. Now, I don't know a lot about gardening. Concrete paving stones is all I have at the back of my back door, which some describe as a garden, but I describe them as concrete paving stones. But nonetheless, I know enough about gardening to know that if you put two seeds in a tub, only two plants ought to grow. And if you put one of one type and one of another type, you ought to get one of each of the types that you've put in. I think that's fairly obvious. Well, the two seeds that have been planted, the two types of seed that have been planted, are now fully grown. And now they're separated. But isn't it striking to see how those two seeds are labelled? How they're described? You see, if you go down to the garden centre and buy a packet of seeds, it'll often have a picture on the front of it of what you're expecting will grow. But it also ought to have across the top the name of the seed. And it'll usually be in some Latin, in unintelligible sort of gobbledygook. But nonetheless, it'll tell you the name of the seed. The separation of the weeds and the wheat. But what are the names of the seeds of those? Two types. Look at them, if you will. There's the sons of the kingdom. And there's the sons of the evil one, or the devil. This separation at harvest time isn't just separating good and evil, notice. It's not just a parable about abstract good and evil that somehow will be divided at some point. It's not about forces that are waging against each other but will one day be stopped. This isn't just a horticultural Star Wars. No, this separation is of two types of people. Notice they're both described as sons. Here's a separation of people. A separation of people who are living and those who are dead at the end of time. And there are only these two groups. Either sons of the kingdom or sons of the devil. I remember a couple of years ago I went skiing and took a group of about 90 people skiing. And on the first morning, we went up on the slopes and the ski instructor asked the whole group of 90, he said, "Now those of you who have skied before, will you stand on this side? And those of you who have never skied before, will you stand on this side, the other side?" And one person in the group, there's always one who probably wasn't the brightest, chirped up and said, "I've been to this resort before, but I've never skied before. Which group should I stand in?" Well, the ski instructor didn't invent a third group. He was sent to the non-skiers. There are only two groups. And it's been a feature of Matthew's gospel all the way so far, and it becomes one of his most dominant themes in the gospel. There are only two groups. So in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 7, there are only two gates. There's a wide one or a narrow one. There are only two trees, the ones that bear fruit and the ones that don't bear fruit. There are only two house builders, a wise one and a foolish one. In the narrative section of Matthew chapters 8 and 9, we're met with two responses to Jesus. There are those who follow and there are those who reject. And even here in Matthew chapter 13, if you turn back the page to verses 11 to 17, as he explains to his disciples why he teaches using parables, he says in his answer in verse 11 that he does say why, because there are two types of people. To you, that is to the disciples, has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven. But to them, to the crowds, it has not been given. Two types of people. And it's striking that there are only two. Because so many people wish that there was more than that. But somehow there was a third group. Especially when you see how the seeds are described. They're not just people, sons, but notice where they come from. That's what's so striking and so uncomfortable. One group of the seeds are sons of the evil one, of the devil. A person is either a son of the kingdom or a son or daughter of the devil. And the separation coming at harvest time will clearly show which of those two groups of people you and I belong to. The two types. You see, there's no third group. There's no third group for the good non-Christian, or for the sympathetic unbeliever, or for the sitter on the fence, or for the very generous and charitable humanist. It's either son of the kingdom or son of the devil. And so if the description of the present situation applies very directly to Christians, then this future separation that's going to happen must be there to make us ask the question, which are we? And to be sure that we know which side of the divide we will come. And let me say tonight that if it's likely that you're going to be in the bundle of weeds separated from the wheat, then it's time to change the situation. It's time to take action. And especially so because of the third movement of this parable. And that's the final state. Turn back to the parable on page 13 if you've moved away from it. The final state. And again, verse 30. The weeds, they're gathered. The weeds, they're gathered and they're separated from the wheat. They're bundled together. Why? So that they can be burnt. There's nothing more that you do with weeds. Yeah, what do you do with your weeds when you eventually get round to pulling them up in the garden? Yeah, John Samuel, earlier this week, told me that he spent all his day off on Wednesday helping his next-door neighbour do the garden. Now, what did he do with the weeds? Do you think he planted them in his own garden? He's not saying no. Well, he burnt them or black sacked them so that someone else will burn them. Because weeds are rubbish. And you just burn them or throw them away. But verse 30, in contrast, what happens to the wheat? Well, it too will be gathered. But it'll be gathered to be placed into the owner's barn. Wheat and weed separated into these two groups, but then come the two destinations. And the destinations are burn or barn. Well, turn over, and in verses 42 and 43 we see Jesus' explanation of this. You may find it uncomfortable, you may not like it, but here it is from the lips of Jesus. And throw them, that's all the evil seeds, throw them into the furnace of fire, and there they will weep and gnash their teeth. Very striking, isn't it? The final state. These two destinations, well, for the sons of the evil one, there in verse 42, it's a description that's horrific. A description characterized by fire, weeping, and gnashing of teeth. Well, some of you may know that there's a big theological debate going on at the moment among Bible-believing Christians about this final state. Will there be conscious, continuous, eternal suffering, or will it be destruction? Of annihilation. Those who think it'll be continuous point to the weeping and gnashing. They're in the present continuous tense. It goes on and on and on. Those who think it's destruction or annihilation look at the picture here of the fire, and they say that, you know, when you burn a fire, the thing you burn is consumed and it is no more. Well, the language here of verse 42 must be pictorial, because the language of verse 43 must be pictorial. For the other group, the final state, for the Christian, must be picture language. We're going to shine like the sun. But although it's picture language, we must not let go of its seriousness. This is horrific, verse 42. My own view is that the Bible does teach that this suffering will be continuous, will go on and on. But whatever your view, the point is that we can't escape the horror. The horror of this final state. And that's why we do need to be sure that we know where we're heading. Avoid this destruction at all costs. Avoid this destination at all costs. If disciples living in the present, when Jesus was speaking, were tempted to think that the kingdom of heaven didn't seem all that impressive, and therefore tempted to go the way of the evil one, tempted to reject Christ perhaps because it seemed easier, well, they only need look forward. Look forward. Look forward to the final state. Yes, some of you may have seen the Everyman program 3 weeks ago, focusing on Kensington Temple. And they interviewed a woman who was shopping. And at the checkout, she talked to the checker-outer about the gospel and invited her along to a church service that they were having. And the interviewer asked her why she did that. And her reply? Well, her reply was that she couldn't bear the thought of people going to hell. The horror of this destination. And if nothing else motivates us into evangelism, surely this must. If nothing else motivates us to keep going as a Christian, surely this must. Well, the final state. For the sons of the evil one, it's horrific. But notice, for the sons of the kingdom, verse 43, it's very different in contrast. The righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Imagery again, but it's imagery of glory, imagery of permanence, imagery of relationship. A wonderful opposite to the horror. To the opposite of the horror of hell, we have the glory of heaven. And that's the final state for the Christian. The glorious final state for the Christian. something that certainly is worth looking forward to, something that's worth keeping going for. Now the kingdom may seem very different. Jesus' rule may seem very different now. It may be very hard for us, some of us. There will be suffering. There will be hardships. Evils all around. But it's not all there is. It's not all there is. What it seems like is not in reality what it is, or will it be? Because one day the Christian will be fully in this kingdom with the King. There'll be no evil, no evildoers, and nothing that can cause us to do evil, to contaminate it. And the present situation, it's going to be this coexistence. The future separation, there's going to be a great division, and there are only two groups to divide into. And the final state, there's a destination of horror, but there's also a destination of wonderful glory. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we thank you that the Bible is full of realism and tells us things as they really are. Thank you for this help, that understanding the world as it is today is to us to go on living in it. And help us not to lose heart by the evil we see, but to go on trusting Jesus as King. And Lord, as we see this warning of the future separation and the final state, Lord, it motivates us to want to tell others about the good news, that it's possible to be secure for eternity, that it's possible to be sure that we will be in the glory of heaven. And Lord, therefore, we pray that you would help us to stay involved in the real world. Help us to be involved, help us to stand, and help us to witness for Jesus Christ's sake. Amen.